The lecture by Rabbi David Kaplan. Rabbi Kaplan is originally from Chicago. He attended Northeastern University and received his rabbinical ordination in Jerusalem. He has lectured widely in Israel and America and is currently a senior lecturer at the main campus in Jerusalem.
The mitzvah to not eat the meat of a chatas, a sin offering, where the blood is sprinkled on the inner altar. All right, this is a technical mitzvah. Remember, there are two altars. There's the external altar, there's the internal altar, the mizbeach hazav, the golden altar, which is inside, in the holy. Right. So there were certain times during the year where the blood of the sacrifices were sprinkled. Normally, the blood was sprinkled on the outside altar. That was one of the services that was done with the blood. The Kohen would take the blood from the sacrifice, he would go up to the altar, and he would sprinkle the blood on the altar. There was certain times, certain sacrifices where he sprinkled the blood on the internal altar, right? The small internal altar. And the mitzvah is to not eat the meat of those sacrifices. The following sacrifices, just in case you want to know, just to quickly refresh the memory. There were two altars in the base of Mikdash, right? Remember how these were structured? Here's the Holy of Holies. Right, the Kodesh HaKadoshim, which we called previously the KKK, right? So the Kodesh HaKadoshim, right, or the Holy of Holies. Then you have over here the Holy, or the Kodesh. And over here you have the sanctuary. Now out here, you've got the altar with the ramp on it, right? A little point on the altar over here. This is where most of the blood was sprinkled, on this altar. There's a small altar here, the golden altar where they burnt the incense, and only for specific individual sacrifices would they sprinkle the blood of the sacrifices in here. Any sacrifices where they sprinkled the blood in here, they were generally communal sacrifices, communal sin offerings, that animal was not eaten. That animal was completely burnt on the altar.
These altars were cleaned, like once a week.
Yes, they could rinse down. The base of meters was clean on a regular basis. But again, while we're on the subject, I didn't mean this to be the trigger. I didn't mean that story to be the trigger point. But while we're on the subject of blood, the Kohanim were you were waiting around in blood in the base of meters. There was an awful lot of blood on the floor of the base of meters. Right, animals were being sacrificed. Blood was being sprinkled all over the place. Right.
So they have good shoes.
No, they're actually barefoot. So I guess the blood felt good, or there's some warmth for their cold feet, right? But they were barefoot in the base of Midrash, right? There were no shoes. Like, they were barefoot. There was a room in the base. There was room in the base of Midrash, because imagine walking around barefoot on these floors right now. The base of Midrash is just about 10 minutes away over here, right? Imagine a Kohen working in the base of Midrash in this time of year in his bare feet, right? It gets kind of cold. So there was one room in the base of Midrash where they kept the fire burning all the time. It's a 24-hour fire burning, so the Kohanim could go in there, any of the Kohanim could go in there and warm their feet, right, up against the fire. Yeah, it gets cold, right? That's fine. Okay, so that's Mitzvah 139. Mitzvah 140, again, technical mitzvah of the Kohen. There's something called the Ashram. The Ashram is the guilt offering, and the mitzvah is that the Kohen should bring the guilt offering and perform the guilt offering service the way he is supposed to. Okay, just with all the technical halachas that go with it. Now, 141 is one we want to get to. There's a sacrifice called the shlamim. The shlamim means literally, if you had to translate it, would probably be the well-being sacrifice. Right? Now, the mitzvah, let me tell you, technically the mitzvah is, mitzvah 141, is that the Kohen must perform the shlamim sacrifice the way it's meant to be performed. Now, what is the shlamim sacrifice? So first of all, there are three types of shlamim. Again, a shlamim is a well-being offering. There are three types of shlamim that you bring. A shlamim is basically an offering where the owner is going to do most of the consumption. Right? What's in the root of the word shlamim? Shalom. Shalom or shalem, right? Shalem and shalom are shalem means whole, shalom means peace. when is there peace? When the unit is whole. When is there lack of peace? When there's fragmentation, right? Shalem, the whole, when people are whole, people are together, then you have shalom. when people are not together, people are warring with each other, then you don't have shalom. Now, the mitzvah is like this. It's a very interesting mitzvah. When does a person bring a shlem? So we know for certain aveiras, you bring certain sacrifices. When do you bring a shlemim? Now, one type of shlemim, probably the most common type of shlemim, is called a korban toda. What does the word toda mean?
Thank you.
Thank you, right? Toda, right? In modern Hebrew, you say toda. It's called in art, it's called korban toda. Right? Now, this korban toda is a Thanksgiving offering. When does a person bring a Thanksgiving offering? So the Gemara says there are four situations. No, not on Thanksgiving. No, they actually say, do you know why you eat turkey on Thanksgiving? Because turkey in Hebrew is hodu, right? Hodu is thank you, right? That's what they say, but that's shtriot. It's nonsense, right? There, there's nothing to do with it, but the early pilgrims didn't speak Hebrew. The korban toda, which is brought for four basic reasons why you would bring a korban toda. If you were saved from some type of life-threatening situation, the Gemara gives the example, a person that was either freed from jail, he crossed the sea, right? You went off on a sea journey and you successfully, in those days, crossing the sea was dangerous. Right? When you crossed the sea, so sometimes your ships didn't make it. They could fall off the edge of the earth, or the winds could you know, there'd be a storm at sea. The seas were not quite the pirates and the vessels were not quite the seaworthy vessels that the Queen Elizabeth is, and all these other massive ships that are the Titanic, right? All these other ships, the sea vessels were not quite as sturdy. So it was very dangerous, considered dangerous to travel the seas. If somebody left jail, somebody crossed the sea, somebody who was lost in the desert, and he got out of the desert, right? Because the desert obviously is a place where it's very easy for a person to die. And the last one is somebody who recovered from an illness. Now, the commentaries say you could bring it as thanks for anything. These are the four basic categories, but you can basically bring it any time you want to give thanks to God. You did well on your exams, right? I know a Jew in the time of the Beis Hamikdash, he did well on his exams, and he says, I want to thank God. He takes a sacrifice, and he comes up to Yerushalayim to bring the sacrifice. Nowadays, just while we're on the subject, what does a person do nowadays when he's been in a dangerous situation? You give tzedakah. It's one of the things you can do, but there's something official. You bench gomel. You make the bracha. There's a bracha, you get called up to the Torah, and you make a bracha, you bench gomel. You thank God for having spared your life. Now, this is only a person who's been in a life-threatening situation, not somebody who's been in a near miss, right? Because if it's a near miss, so... then it's literally endless, because it's not, let's say you're driving a car, and as you're driving like this, all of a sudden, at the last second you swerve and you get around the car, you don't make a bracha over in that situation. That's a near miss. You would bench gomel if the person was actually in a car accident, in a car crash, and he didn't get killed, then he benches gomel. Somebody, not only that, there are people who actually make a festive meal to commemorate the anniversary of the day that they've been in a life, but we had a guy in our neighborhood, the first time I ever saw somebody do it, a guy in our neighborhood who was in an accident a couple of years ago, the car hit him, he went flying, right, he was unconscious, lying on the sidewalk, and in the meantime, a truck apparently slammed on his brakes and came within that close of hitting him. So this guy makes, and he was for a while, he was out of it, and then he makes, on the anniversary of that date, he makes a festive meal thanking God for having spared him. But an ordinary situation, let's say a person a plane crash, certainly. Somebody's in a plane crash, they manage to survive it, they bench gomel. Somebody attends a British soccer match and survives it, right? you bench gomel, right? The most common example is probably a woman who gives birth, right? Now, giving birth is inherently a life-threatening situation.
In the Midwest.
Huh?
Just being pregnant.
Somebody gets your hand. a woman who gives birth is inherently what's considered a life-threatening situation. Chas Hashem, I told you, there's this woman in our neighborhood who still does not have any, has lost all sensation below the waist, right, from when she gave birth. They still have that. They messed up the doctors in the hospital. If this was the United States, they would make millions, literally millions. Yeah. After that, she was in the hospital. And after birth, she did not have any feeling in her legs, and she told them about it in the hospital. This was on Friday. She wanted to get taken care of. They told her not to worry. finally Sunday morning, instead of doing it right away Sunday morning, they did a CAT scan. The CAT scan showed a blood clot on her spine, right, which may have been a result of the epidural, the injection that they give in order to deaden the pain. They finally had to do emergency surgery, and since then she still has not, doctor said, a 30% chance of the feeling returning to her legs, right? But whatever that is.
Well, the rocket downstairs, someone seems to pay for a woman to the fire.
Yeah, it could be. That's the thing. It's him, right? And in the meantime, that's the thing. So giving birth is a dangerous situation, right? There are situations, class of Shelma, a woman could die. We had another woman in the neighborhood who was in a situation where some of the fluid from the inside the placenta, the fluid leaks out. Somehow it gets into the lungs, right? That causes a drop in heart pressure, and it's a potentially life-threatening situation. Somebody under those circumstances has to bench gomel, right? A woman bench gomel. Not a custom in certain communities, the husband makes the bracha for the wife. In other communities, the wife, you get 10 men together, and the woman makes the bracha behind a mechitza or something. She makes the bracha. Either way, that's a life-threatening situation. One of the interesting halachic questions nowadays is somebody who travels by air, right? Plane travel. So our custom is that when you've made a plane trip from America to Israel, from any of the third world countries, South Africa, to Israel, right? So when you've gone overseas, right, you make the bracha. When you get to Israel, you bench gomel, right?
There's not a lot of things you're
trying. Oh, so some argue that it's not. Now, it's interesting. Rav Moshe Feinstein writes that if you're traveling domestically, you don't make the bracha. Because after all, to travel over, travel to fly from one city to another is no big deal. However, because in the Talmud discusses specifically sea travel, so there are those halakhic authorities who contend it's not the flying that's dangerous. Flying is safer than driving. It's not the flying that's dangerous as much as the fact that you're crossing the sea. In crossing the sea, you've entered into a specifically more dangerous situation than normal. There are other halakhic authorities, like you say, there are other authorities who say that it's so routine that they don't make the bracha. They do not bench gomel. The custom among most people is that you do bench gomel. Right,
fall asleep at the wheel and go off the road. Nothing happens, really.
If you entered into a situation which is an inherently dangerous situation, you didn't almost fall asleep at the wheel.
You fell asleep
and you went off the side of the road, and you went into danger, that you probably would bench gomel. Because just falling asleep at the wheel, you probably bench gomel. That's inherently already a dangerous situation. Certainly if you went off the road. But you understand that you can't make the bracha for near misses, because every time you eat, it's a near miss. Right? Every time you eat, you should bench gomel versus you should bench gomel. They didn't choke. Right? Every time you plug a plug into the socket, you should bench gomel. They didn't get electrocuted. All it would have taken was for the current to go, right? So you could only make the bracha when you've been in that situation. Now, when a person brought the korban to Eli,
what about those situations where there's those things? Do you have to bring the things off the altar if you don't want to?
I think that you're obligated, under those circumstances, you're obligated to give a Thanksgiving offering.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, in a situation where you've done it, I mean, I'll tell you, it's not the type of thing you want to mess around with. Right, because if you didn't thank God one time, maybe He won't be so good to you the next time. It's not the type of thing. Most people don't need to be persuaded. Most people understand that. I better thank God. But the halach is you're supposed to bench gomel. Okay.
What about someone going to bar mitzvah? Would they say?
If what?
Someone going to bar mitzvah? Would they say gomel if they were a teenager?
Someone survived the bar mitzvah?
Someone below the age of bar mitzvah.
Of somebody below the age of bar mitzvah, theoretically they can make the bracha. Theoretically they can make the bracha.
But you have to make it clear that
not necessarily. You could just walk up to the Torah and make the bracha. I've never seen a cotton do it, but I can't think why halakhically he wouldn't be able to do it.
Once when I was 9, someone was going to kidnap these two guys or something. And I wasn't sure if that was right.
No, it's definitely not right that they should kidnap you.
Yeah.
It's definitely not right that they should kidnap you. But you mean, should you make the bracha? I can't think of any reason. I can't think of any reason not to. While you're making bracha, a child can make a bracha on an apple. And you answer, there's no reason. I can't think of any reason not to. Right? And I've never seen it done, Lamaisa, but I can't think of any reason.
What's the whole thing of doing when you get called up to LA? Why is that?
I guess, you know, you do it in front of the Torah, just a custom. But you don't have to. A woman doesn't get called up to the Torah. You just assemble 10 men and she makes a brother.
Is there like a time limit? I didn't mention Shlomo when I flew over here. Are
they still doing now? That I have to check. I don't know what the time limit is. That I have to check into. I'd have to find out for you. You have to ever check into it. I don't know what the time limit is. Right, you probably, if you've been here a couple of weeks, probably too late. But ideally, a person should do it. Okay, now, when a person brought the Korban Todah, he also brought, along with the Korban Todah, he brought 40 loaves of bread as part of the sacrifice. There were 40 loaves of bread. Yes, this is the most basic shlamim sacrifice. Now he brought 40 loaves of bread. Now, with these 40 loaves of bread, the idea of these 40 loaves of bread is that when he's going to eat the sacrifice, right, that he's bringing, he's going to eat the sacrifice. So he brings the sacrifice, and along with the sacrifice are 40 loaves of bread. Why do you think the Torah would require him to bring so much bread with the sacrifice? Okay, for whom?
It
doesn't have to be eaten by the Kohen. It can be eaten by anybody he wants. What do you think the idea is?
It's a feast.
Exactly. It's a way of celebrating. And when you celebrate, you want to spread the news that a miracle has taken place. So the Torah, 40 is an awful lot. It's a way of spreading. When you're sitting there and somebody's giving you the bread from the sacrifice, what are we celebrating? Well, you're celebrating the fact that so-and-so was saved from the desert. He was lost in the desert, he was saved. Well, that's a way of spreading the news that the miracle has taken place. Remember, we're talking about a miraculous type of saving. Right? Somebody was in the desert, friend was lost in the desert, he made it out of the desert. That's a miracle. Now, why 40 loaves of bread? He brings 40 loaves of bread. What is the number 40? Where does the number 40 come up in the...
Moshe
was on the mountain for 40 days. 40 years in the desert. Where else? The flood was 40 days. What else?
40 Malkus. Well, really, if they're going
on... 40 Malkus. Okay, that's also connected. 40 lashes. It's called 40 lashes, which is actually 39. What is the number 40 in Torah? You find the number 40 all the time. All over the place you find 40. 40 in the flood, 40 years in the desert, 40 days on the mountain, 40. The number 40 always symbolizes, everywhere you see the number 40, you know that an embryo is conceived in 40 days. Right? In 40 days, up until 40 days, a father can, the parents can daven for the gender of the unborn, of the embryo. Once 40 days have taken place, then it's a point of no return, and then you can no longer daven because it's already the fate of the, whatever that gender is supposed to be is already determined. So you can no longer daven, it's a wasted prayer. Right? What does number 40 always represent? If you look through, the common denominator of the number 40 is renewal. Right? Everywhere you look, the number 40 represents renewal. The flood, God decided that he's going to destroy the world and renew it. That flood takes how many days? 40 days of rain. Right? The Jewish people need to be renewed. Their spiritual level is dropped. There's a decree on them that they're going to have to wander the desert. How long do they have to wander for? 40 years in the desert. Moshe Rabbeinu goes up on the mountain. He's turned into a new entity. Moshe Rabbeinu reaches a new spiritual level. It takes 40 days. The embryo certainly is renewal. The mikvah. You know how much the measurement of water that's in a mikvah? You know, when a woman immerses in a mikvah, 40 sa'az. 40 sa'az. It's called 40 gallons, right? The number that's used in halacha to describe how much water has to be in a mikvah for it to be a valid mikvah has to be 40 sa'az. What happens when a woman immerses? Why does a woman go to the mikvah? She's become a nida. What was a nida? A nida is a woman who she's gone through her cycle, and the egg has passed out of her system. What does that represent? Why is she impure? A woman who menstruates, why is she impure? There's a certain connection. What's the prime, when you think of impurity in Torah law, what is the ultimate impure source of impurity?
Death,
a dead body. A woman who has menstruated has lost that potential for life that has been in her system. She's lost that potential for life. That means that she has come into contact with the dead, therefore she is somehow, to a certain extent, she is ritually impure. What does she have to do? She immerses in the mikvah, and the mikvah represents the water in the mikvah with any imagination at all. She has to be totally submerged in the water, and coming out of the mikvah, what do you think, I have to use this expression, what does it represent? Being born again. right? It means it's like coming out of the embryonic fluid. You're being born. What does water symbolize? What is the source of life, right? Water is the life-giving force. A woman immerses in the mikvah, 40 sa'as, she comes out, she is renewed with the renewed potential to create life. That's the idea of the number 40. So you have the number 40 everywhere you look. You were asking about flogging a person, the 39 lashes, right? The Torah refers to the 39 lashes in what expression? Malchus Arboim, right? The lashes of 40. The Torah calls it 40 lashes, yet according to the oral tradition, we know how much is it? It's actually 39. Where else do you see the number 39? For 39 prohibited activities on Shabbat.
In the desert, the tabernacle, 39.
The 39 lashes. Activities, which are the prohibited activities on Shabbat. What do those lashes mean? You know what the 39 by the lashes means? That means, why does the Torah call it 40? When does a person get lashed? Obviously, if a person's done an avera, he's done something wrong. You don't get lashed for mitzvah. People wouldn't do mitzvahs if they got lashed. You got to get lashed for averas, right? The person did something wrong, so the Torah says, you know what, you've got to get lashed. What's the maximum? 40. What's the purpose of the lashes? The purpose of the lashes is that we want this person to change his attitude. We'd like to see a renewed attitude on his part. What's the problem? There's only so much we can do. We can take him to the 39th level, right? That means we can strip away any of the negative influence from him, right? Very effective method, right? Take a whip, flog away, strip away any of that negativity. Right? What about that last step? That last step, there's got to be a certain amount of initiative because of the individual himself. That initiative only he himself can take. So the Torah calls it 40, because the underlying theme of the lashes is renewal. On the other hand, that last step he's got to take, therefore we only hit him 39. But essentially, the idea is the same idea as all the other 40s. Right? That it's an act of renewal. Over here, this man brings the 40 breads. Why is he bringing 40 breads? Obviously because it's a renewal for him, right? His life, theoretically, would have been over, right, had he not experienced this miracle, had he not experienced this salvation from God. Therefore, he brings 40 breads with his Torah as a symbol that his life is renewed. That's the idea of the 40. Do you know that a woman who, a woman by Torah law, has... When she gives birth, when a woman gives birth, the woman who gives birth, she's automatically impure. Do you know that? A woman who gives birth is impure. Why?
Blood.
Okay, there's blood, but what's the underlying idea? Same idea as when she has her period, right? A woman who's given birth, up until this point, she was carrying life within her, right? Then as soon as she's given birth, the life has left her, so to speak. There's a certain type of death in giving birth. There's a form of death. That means death, the definition of death is the separation of life from one source to another. Right? The woman has had life within her. She gives birth. She's missing part of the life that she was carrying. Right? You know that the halacha is fascinating law in the Torah. The Torah says a man, woman gives birth. If she has a son, she's impure for 7 days. She has a daughter, she's impure for 14 days. Right? If he has a daughter, she's impure for double the time. Why? I'm sorry?
It goes to mikvah.
Yeah, that's the way the ritual is afterwards. But the halacha is that for a son, she's impure for 7 days. A daughter, she's impure for 14 days. Right? Why is that? It looks like the Torah is, again, we're picking on women. Let's pick on women, right? Just bear in mind that the ritual impurity, very often, ritual impurity is a symbol of more heightened spirituality, not lesser spirituality. Remember, the impurity of a Jewish body is a higher impurity than a non-Jewish body, right? You would think it should be the opposite, based on everything that we preach, you'd think it should be the opposite, but it's not. The highest form of impurity is a Jewish body. And when a woman gives birth, a higher form of impurity is when her daughter has been born than when the son has been born. Well, that tells you something about the daughter, doesn't it? It doesn't tell you the daughter is blessed. There's something more elevated about the daughter than the son. What's the secret? The idea is that when a woman gives birth to a son, the life is separated from her. When she's given birth to a daughter, two lives have separated from her. There's the daughter herself, and the fact that the daughter's got the potential to bring more life. Right? She's lost the double potential.
right? And therefore, for there, there's double period of impurity, up and of impurity, as the Torah says. That's the idea. That's the idea. That's the idea of the mikveh. That's the idea of the ritual purity in general. Okay. That was 141. Now we're going to hit five or six technical mitzvahs. We'll go through this very fast. We could skip this. If anybody's interested in this, I'll give it to you later if you want, right? But it's really just technical mitzvahs having to do with the sacrifices. There are six or seven of them. I'd rather go to mitzvah 100, and I'll fill this in. Anybody who wants this? If anybody wants it, just stay after class and I'll give it to you, right?
The 39... He gives an extra step for the whipping.
Right.
About the 39 things with the Shabbat, the 39.
Okay, the idea of Shabbat, I heard what Rabbi Levski once explained, it's also the same thing. What's the idea of Shabbat? The idea of Shabbat is
to renew the week.
For a person to renew himself. Right? The idea of Shabbat is for a person to renew, to recharge his spiritual potential. Do you know what is, it's ironic, on Shabbat there are 39 prohibited activities, correct? What's the common bond between these activities? What's the common denominator? They're all creativity, right? Now, isn't it interesting that on Shabbos of all times is when a person has the mitzvah of procreation, the mitzvah to be fruitful and multiply, is in force more on Shabbos than during the week? Shabbos, the person, specifically the mitzvah to be fruitful and multiply, right? Why is that? Because the whole idea of Shabbos is don't make use of the external world for creativity. Shabbos puts an end to that, right? You cannot use those 39 means of creativity. But what is the greatest potential for creativity a person has? Bringing children into the world. That's internal creativity. Shabbos, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from us, on Shabbos, the whole theme of Shabbos is internal creativity. That a person should come in touch with what his spiritual potential is, and part of having children is a spiritual potential. Therefore, the 39 prohibited activities can only, again, the same as the flogging, we can only take you so far. We can only tell you what not to do, right? A person could be told what not to do and then spend the whole Shabbos in bed. Well, then he hasn't accomplished what Shabbos is supposed to accomplish for him, right? That last step of actually achieving something, right, this rejuvenation, spiritual rejuvenation, on Shabbos, that a person, we can't do that for you, that a person has to do on his own. Right, that's the 40th step. That's what corresponds to the 40th step by the other. That's the completion of the unit. That's the idea of Shabbos. It's interesting. Circumcision. Right? You know, circumcision is one of the most fundamental mitzvahs in the Torah. Right? The Torah says that in the mirror of circumcision, heavens and earth were created for circumcision. Right? Circumcision, it's a mitzvah. And the Torah talks about it left, right, and center. It's one of the only two positive commands that if you don't fulfill it, the punishment is premature death. There are many negative commands like that, but positive commands is only a couple, right? Circumcision and the Korban Pesach, the Paschal Lamb. Right? Those are the only positive commands for the punishment of premature death. What is symbolized by circumcision? So circumcision, everybody knows, circumcision is the uncovering of the male's organ, right? What is that? What do you think that means? Okay, cut away a piece of flesh. I mean, so what? What's the big deal? You understand that's the covering, that's covering over all creative potential. Right? And the greatest sin possible is for a person to live his life without achieving his potential, without achieving his creative potential. The removal of the foreskin is symbolic of removing those barriers which will allow for creative potential, right? As opposed to keeping those potentials and using them for selfish purposes. Right? A person removes the barriers and demonstrates that this is going to, and he is uncovering, so to speak, the greatest creative potential which he has, which is to bring children in the world, and that way he's emulating his creator, who is somebody who created, who the creator created, man creates. How do we emulate the creator? We emulate the creator by bringing people into the world. That's the first mitzvah in the Torah and the most fundamental mitzvah of the Torah. Because without that mitzvah, none of the other mitzvahs are possible. Okay, so that's the idea of circumcision, that's the idea of Shabbos. Yeah.
You know that mitzvah? People, Jews that have kids, but they're not religious, and they don't have the kids because of the mitzvah, they have them because they want kids. So is that, do they get credit to do the mitzvah or not? Because
it's not just a question, do you know the Gemara says that if you lose your wallet, and a poor man finds it, you get credited with doing mitzvah. Right?
Now, there are certain mitzvahs which require, is a prerequisite to getting any credit for the mitzvah. They require intent. Right? You can't accidentally do a mitzvah. Right? There are certain mitzvahs that you could accidentally do, certain mitzvahs that you can't accidentally do. Right? Every mitzvah that you do, there's going to be a certain amount of intent. The level of your intent will determine the credit that you get in the mitzvah. Right? Many mitzvahs are like that. Right? How much intent, how much of your thought was contained in the mitzvah? Right? So certain mitzvahs that you put on tefillin in the morning, not enough just to put on tefillin. Just putting on tefillin is good, but you have to have a certain amount of intent. Saying Kriya Shema is not good enough, you have to have a certain amount of intent. So by having children also there has to be a certain amount of intent. Right? So it's relative to the intent that an individual has.
What about a non-Jew who doesn't have to get a circumcision, but he's could still have some sort of intent, he could still understand?
The non-Jew, the circumcision is specifically a covenant between God and the Jewish people. So a non-Jew that circumcises is still considered uncircumcised. He does not fulfill the mitzvah by circumcising. The only one I think there's a debate about the descendants of Yishmael, whether they circumcise, whether they have an obligation to circumcise, whether they fulfill mitzvah. But the non-Jews in general, there's no mitzvah for them to circumcise. Not fulfilling the mitzvah by circumcision.
That's why somebody comes a year later, they start doing it on top of time.
Correct. Because there's no mitzvah for them. Okay.
Is there a mitzvah for them to create, to procreate, or
it appears that there is. Now, it's not actually one of the seven Noahide laws, but it appears that that's a fundamental, that they're not allowed to waste seed. Right, that's also fundamental for them. How much, what the extent of the prohibition, whether or not it's in the category of forbidden relationships, that I'm not sure about. Right, but that seems to be for them also. There's some type of inherent obligation to procreate. Okay. So let's skip. I'll fill in the other ones in a little while. Let's skip to mitzvah 148.
Now, whose listing is this?
This is the Sefer Achinuch. This is going according to the Sefer Achinuch. Mitzvah 148 is the prohibition of eating blood. Right?